The story that we read in the book of 1 Kings chapter 18 is also one of my absolute favorite stories. God shows up in a really big way in 1 Kings chapter 18. Now, before we get into the story itself, let me give you some context. So, this is a very difficult time for the nation of Israel, and it's difficult because of their own unfaithfulness. They have turned from Yahweh and are serving other gods. They are bowing down to idols. Not only is it a season of religious turmoil and unfaithfulness, but it is also one of political upheaval. You see, unlike our country today, where there is a clear separation of church and state, that wasn't true for the nation of Israel. All right, there was a close connection between the king of Israel and the worship of Israel. Well, there is a king sitting on the throne by the name of Ahab. His wife Jezebel are two of the most wicked people you will read about in the Bible. Jezebel is extremely evil. She goes out of her way to cause harm and to oppress people. So this, there are not only spiritual problems, but there are political problems. And so because of Israel's unfaithfulness, God raises up a faithful and righteous prophet named Elijah to call his people back to faithfulness. And part of this process is Israel has been so unfaithful, God has chastised them by bringing a drought upon the nation of Israel. And things are getting desperate. People are hungry. People are starving. This drought has been going on for 3 years. And God says it's finally time to act. It's time to bring this to an end. And so he calls Elijah up on what we know as Mount Carmel. And there is this face-off between the prophets of Baal, 450 of them, and this single prophet of God named Elijah. And so there is this, again, this big face-off. And God shows up in a big way. And what's interesting is, in the passages that we've looked at in the past in this series, God typically shows up to an individual. Now he's going to show up to an entire group. He's going to reveal himself to an entire nation. And when God shows up, it's not so much that we can know what he looks like, but what he is like, what his nature is. And he shows up for a reason. And there are several of them in 1 Kings chapter 18. The first one, and we're not going to reread the text that Cole did such a great job doing, all right? I will make reference to it, so you want to have your Bibles open. We will look at specific verses. God shows up, number one, to shame the idols. He shows up to shame the idols. This scene shows us ancient idols and the way people sacrificed to them. All right, and they do it in a very demeaning way, an undignified way. They often, as you will see in the text, would even cause themselves self-harm in the worship and service of these idol gods. They get so drastic that as they're calling out to Baal in the story, they begin to cut themselves with swords and spears, spilling their own blood, trying to win the favor of their god. But what we see in this text is that there is only one true God. He is the God over all. Now, when you read the name Baal in the text, you may think that this is one particular god. But the name Baal was attributed to a lot of different gods in this region. They had a fertility god who went by the name Baal. They had a harvest god, a sun god. And what's interesting is most people think that the particular god that the prophets of Baal are focused on right now is the storm god, the god of rain, which makes sense, right? God is setting up this giant showdown. There's been a drought for 3 years with this God who controls all things, is the creator of all things, with this one particular God who apparently is the god of rain. And so it's not just one God, but it is a series of gods. But there's one particular that the text is focusing on. And I'm sure that these prophets of Baal have been crying for years, begging for rain so that their crops would grow and so that they could feed their families. And I'm sure they sense feel a sense of powerlessness as they stand unable to convince their God to act on their behalf. And so Elijah says, let's have a contest. Let's kill two bulls. You build an altar. You cry out to your God. We'll see which one is the true and living God. What I like about this is that Elijah engages in some Old Testament trash talk. Because they cry out for a long period of time, begging Baal to come down and consume this sacrifice with fire. And he mocks him and says, well, maybe he's gone on a trip. Or maybe he's meditating. What's interesting is most translations, all right, translate the word meditating so as to not offend us. If you read some of the more straightforward text, you find that he's just not sitting and pondering life. No, the text says maybe he is relieving himself. And this isn't a quick trip to the John. All right, he's grabbed a magazine. He's going to be in there for a while. The kids are knocking on the door. Hey, Dad, when are you coming out? Or maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's fallen asleep. Why would they consider a God to be... I mean, this is what the prophets of Baal believed about their God, that he was capable of going and doing these things. You see, when we make up an idol, a god, it looks a lot like us. And typically, what we do is that we have control over this god. He is there to serve our purposes. Now, when it comes to idolatry, we like to distance ourselves from our pagan forefathers. We're not so silly as to think that there is an actual God out there who has gone to the restroom to relieve himself, or has gone on a trip and is unavailable, or that he is taking a nap. Or we're not so naive to actually build a carving out of stone or wood or precious metal and bow down to it. No, we want to, you know, distance ourselves. We're not that naive. But one thing I have to give the prophets of Baal is that at least they were honest about who they worship. So I still believe we have idols today. We all have idols that we need to tear down in our hearts. But we're not as honest about it. And what happens in this story is it goes from satire to a state of sickness and sadness, again, because they begin to self-harm. It was their habit, their way of worship. They're bleeding for their God. That's how seriously they take this. My question is, how do we know whether or not we have idols in our own lives? Because again, they're often more subtle than what we read about on the pages of the Old Testament. Paul would even say in his letters that covetousness is a form of idolatry. So what are some of the modern day idols that people worship, and how can we identify idols in our own lives? Well, I think we can identify them by stopping and thinking about what we give our identity to. What we're all wrapped up about. What do we think about? What consumes us? What are we willing to dance for, sacrifice for, sweat for? What are we willing to give to and for? And here's the thing. We may think, you know, they're cutting themselves literally in this story. But the idols that we serve do just as much harm, if not more harm, to us today. And the truth of the matter is they leave us empty and hurting. So let me ask you this, rather than just me answering the question, which I will give you my opinion, what are modern day idols that we worship today? Let's just stay in our own context, our own country, our own culture. What are some idols that we worship in our culture today? Materialism, consumerism, entertainment, convenience, sports teams. Getting a little too close to home there, Matt. Go blue. What else? Comfort. Instant gratification. Can you think of anything else? What do you think the biggest idol in America is today? Comfort, money, cars, ourselves, serving self. We live in a very individualistic, selfish society. Anybody else? What'd you say, Sarah?
Cell phones.
Cell phones. Yeah, the need to have something before our eyes, something entertaining us, diverting our attention. Let's go back to what Cole said for just a minute. Politics. Do you think that is an idol that many people within American Christianity struggle with? I believe it is. In fact, it may be the most powerful in this day and age. So how do you know? Let's just run with what Cole has said, because it's in my notes. Convenient, huh? How do you know if you've made politics an idol? I'll let you answer the question, and then I'll give you some ideas. How do you know if you've made politics an idol? All right, if the right party's in, we're safe. If it's not, we're doomed. What else? All right. We place our hope in the future of our politics, our candidates, our nation, rather than in God and His kingdom. Okay. All right. It becomes divisive, right? So I got to thinking about this, and I came up with a really long list, like 40-some things that might be ways of discerning whether or not we have made politics an idol. And I thought, how am I going to present this? Because this is a long list, and I'm not going to give them all 40 of them. All right? Would you like me to give you all 40? I didn't think so. All right? I know my audience. All right? This is not my first rodeo. So I got to thinking, you know, I used to love David Letterman's top 10, all right, top 10 things. All right, so I narrowed it down. I think I've got it down to 20, all right. I'll read them quickly. You just tell me if any of them ring a bell or convict you. And if any of them make you mad, all right, they get your ire up. That may be the best clue yet that you're making politics an idol. All right? And what I'm about to say does not apply to one particular party. All right? This is universal. These are global, I think, tests we can apply. The language kind of tilts towards American culture because we are Americans living in this country. But you can form a similar list and ask them to someone who's British, Russian, Chinese, Iranian, Israeli, Australian. All right? These are universal principles. So here we go. You may have made politics an idol if you're prioritizing your political allegiance over your faith. Number two, equating national identity with faith, that they're one in the same. Remember, the gospel isn't exclusive to your zip code or to your party or government. Viewing the Bible through a political lens. If every verse supports your agenda, you may need new glasses. Demonizing opponents. You know, even your neighbors with a different yard sign deserve your love and respect. They're human, made in the image of God. compromising Christian values for political gain. If you're selling out your faith for votes, it's time to reevaluate. You may have turned politics into an idol if you idolize political leaders. Remember, there's only one king who deserves your ultimate trust, hope, and allegiance. And his name is not on the ballot. American politics is too small for Jesus. He's king of the earth, not the king of the United States. American politics is much too small for him. So no, his name shouldn't be on the ballots. You may have turned politics into an idol if you lack prophetic critique. If you're never critique your own party, platform, leader, then you're missing out on the prophetic call to truth. In other words, your guy or your team can never do any wrong. Polarizing rhetoric, divisive language, may win debates, but it loses the love of Christ. Seeking political power over servanthood. Jesus washed feet. He did not ever run for office. Confusing the kingdom of God for a political agenda. Spoiler alert, God's kingdom isn't tied to any political party. You may have turned politics into an idol if you've weaponized faith. If your faith feels more like a weapon than a witness, you may be off target. You may have made politics an idol if you are ignoring the poor and vulnerable. If your politics leave out the least of these, that's what Jesus called them, then it's time to reevaluate. One thing that always irritates me is that we want the government to be an instrument of God's wrath, his judgment, his punishment, but we never talk about God's using kingdoms to be an instrument of his grace or his goodness or his generosity, one without the other. By the way, you can't have in Romans 13 without having Romans 12. They go together. You may have turned politics into an idol if you believe your country's ways are superior and its constitution is divine, while forgetting that God's kingdom transcends national borders. You may have turned politics into an idol if you view your national destiny as divinely ordained. Saw a sign the other day that said God has only chose two nations, Israel and the United States. Nothing could be further from the truth. You aim to enforce Christian ethics through political power, forgetting that true transformation comes from the heart, not legislation. That you want to legislate Christian values, not just Christian values, but Christian dominance. This is one that really struck me. You may have turned politics into an idol if you feel closer to an atheist who votes like you rather than a believer who votes differently. Causing division. I could go on and on, but let me give you the last one. You may have turned politics into an idol if you find it easier to leave your church over political disagreements rather than challenge your own political views based on your faith. I've known a lot of people who will leave church over politics, but have never left the political party because of their faith. I believe that we are in danger of making politics an idol amongst all the other things that we listed. But the good thing about it is that God not only shows up to shame the idols, God shows up to show off, right, in this text. He's going to reveal who is the true God rather than this idol. And so Elijah has them pour water, jars of water, over these idols. And don't think a mason jar, right? Think a barrel of water. So it seems as if it's impossible that something could transpire without divine intervention. What God is doing is putting things in contrast. God's incredible capacity, all right, putting his excessive power on display by saying, listen, you guys called and called and called. You cut yourselves. You couldn't get your God to light the altar on fire and the sacrifice. All right, it's my turn. But before I do it, we're going to soak this thing in water. Have you ever gone camping and tried to burn damp wood? It's frustrating, isn't it? This isn't just damp wood. It's soaking wet. But God is stepping in and said, listen, there are some things that human beings who are broken and sinful can't do on their own. I have to show up and do it. Because I'm the one with the power. You ever lost hope with somebody? Maybe they've given themselves to an idol. Let's just put maybe addiction. They've given themselves, their bodies over, and it's consumed their lives, their souls, their spirits. And you've tried every resource you can think of to try to pull them back from their addiction, and nothing seems to help until God steps in and shows up. The great thing about God is that he doesn't only just show his power in ways like he does in the story with Elijah, with this physical manifestation of fire coming from heaven. God shows his power through his grace. His grace is an excessive demonstration of his power, is it not? So God shows up to shame the idols, to show off, all right? But he doesn't just show off his power for no reason, just so he can brag. All right, that he's a better God than Baal. No, he shows off with a purpose. God shows up to change hearts. God's people were living like they didn't belong to God. And God brings his presence and power to restore relationship with them. He didn't want and he will not accept half-hearted allegiance. He just won't. Remember how the story starts. Go back to 1 Kings chapter 18. A question is asked of the people. In verse 20, it says, how long will you go limping in two different opinions or in two different ways? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. Too many of us want to settle for pseudo-commitment. But partial obedience is a form of disobedience. We won't truly give ourselves to God. We have trouble answering this question. How long will we limp between two opinions? We show up on Sundays, we sing some songs, we listen to the sermon, and then we live the rest of our weeks as functional atheists. But it's time to make a decision. It's time to make up our mind. Too many Christians are playing church. Let me tell you, church or Christianity is a terrible hobby. Just think about it for a minute. You have to get up on your day off. You have to get up early rather than sleeping in. And you have to drag yourself to church, all right, sing songs that don't really make you want to tap your foot, and listen to a sermon maybe you'd rather not hear. But if God is the one true God, then what we do here is revolutionary. If he is the one true God, then we ought to follow, submit, and surrender to him. Far too many Christians around the world are just partially committed to their God. They come and they consume religious goods and services. But they aren't committed to serving and following Jesus in any other real way. And God calls us to more than that. When will we make a decision and go all in for God? When will we? How long will we limp between two opinions? Now, I'm sure there's some young fellas in here that would like some dating advice, so I'm going to give them some. You find this really cute girl and you get her number. Maybe she gives it to you or a friend gives it to you. You text her. Would you like to go to the movies Friday night? And it takes her a day, maybe two, to answer. And maybe she's like, well, you know, I got to study for this exam on Monday. So she puts you off. So you let the week go by, and on Wednesday or Thursday, you ask her again, hey, you want to go to the movies this Friday night? Well, you know, my dog's been sick, and I need to stay home and nurse him back to health. Or you wait again and you ask again. She's got another excuse. and another excuse and another excuse. And she'll never actually give you an answer. Will you go to the movies with me? By not answering the question, guess what? She's answered the question. The answer is no. You're never going to the movies with her. Some of us just act like, we don't really need to answer this question about Jesus. You know, he says, come, follow me, take up your cross. Yeah, I put that off. No answer is an answer. Let's go all in for God. If he is the one true God, let's follow him, submit to him, and surrender to him. I promise you won't regret it. We're going to sing a song in just a minute. It's Behold Our God. Now, Fred's not going to lead this because it's one of our newer songs, and so we're actually going to play the video, and I'm going to ask you to stand and sing with the video. Try not to listen, all right? But before we do that, I want to say this to you. There was a man by the name of Pete Allender. He was the director at the Surprise Valley Youth Camp when I first started going to that camp as a counselor and as a teacher. And Pete was just phenomenal with the kids. And we had chapel twice every day, once in the morning and once in the evening. And in the evening, someone would get up and there'd be a devotional talk. But in the morning, Pete would just field questions from the kids from the audience. And I don't remember what question he was answering, but I remember his answer. I think it was maybe, how can you be happy in life? Something along those lines. And this is what he said. He said, you want to get to the end of life with as few regrets as possible. So make wise decisions. So that when you get to the end, you're not looking back and going, man, I wish I hadn't done this, or I wish I had done this. Get to the end of life with as few regrets as possible. And I say that to say this: going all in with God, allowing him to remove the idols from your life, following him, committing to him, surrendering him, is not something you're going to regret when you get to the end of your life. He's worth it. His grace and love are excessive displays of his power and his desire to be with us. So I encourage you, check your heart. What idols are living there, consuming your loyalty and allegiance that should be given to God and him alone? Stand back, behold your God. What is he calling you to? How can you be more faithful? Let's stand and sing.